We were talking about enzymes. What are enzymes, first of all? Chemically, what are they? Or molecularly, what are they?
They're like sugars, right?
No. They're proteins. What are they functionally?
They speed up. I remember you brought an example for the diamond, right? Like they speed up the process of the...
Yeah, what do we call such things? They're catalysts, right. They're biological catalysts. And they're proteins, because proteins can have just about any shape that you want if you're actually designing them. Of course, natural selection is not designed, but that's why proteins are ideally suited for being enzymes. I mean, for catalysts, because... they work based on their shape. They have to be just the right shape for the reactants to fit in so that the reaction between those reactants gets sped up. And what do we call the reactants of a catalyzed reaction? I mean, they can be called reactants, but if an enzyme is involved, if a catalyst is involved, what do we call the reactants? They are examples of ligands, but specifically they're called the substrate. The substrate is the reactant, and it binds to an enzyme, which is not a reactant, importantly, right? Because if it were a reactant, it would get changed into a product. Enzymes are reusable because all they do is help out the reactants. They don't get changed themselves in the process. So the substrate, or substrates, depending on whether there's one or more for the reaction, bind to a specific place on the enzyme called the active site. And that's what brings about the acceleration of the reaction. But no catalyzed reaction requires a catalyst. It's just that it's not going to happen nearly as quickly if the catalyst isn't there to help. Okay? Now in 13, we're looking at a graph that represents a chemical reaction. So its progress of the reaction means before, during, and after. But you start, of course, with some number of reactants, and you end up with some number of products. For just this generic example, you have something that's made up of A and B, and something that's made up of C and D. Those are two reactants. They get rearranged, though. In any given chemical reaction, by definition of it being a chemical reaction, some chemical bonds need to get broken and new ones need to form, because chemical reactions are rearrangements, right? So you end up with different stuff with different bonds than the reactants had. So you see this in the products. Now A and C are hooked together, B and D are hooked together. That just represents a rearrangement of bonds. But the point here is that in order for a chemical reaction to actually proceed from reactants to products, some bonds need to be broken, some bonds need to be formed, and that is not just an instantaneous thing. It actually requires a little bit of time, and therefore there is a very short time when there is a so-called transition state, represented here by the squiggly lines, where these are bonds that are in the process of being broken, and the new ones have not yet formed. So it's not reactant or product. It's somewhere in between. And that is a very much more unstable situation. Now remember last time that I said you should equate in your mind unstable with high G value when we talked about free energy. And the reason that spontaneous things are spontaneous is because the system, the thermodynamic system, is tending toward a more stable situation, which is lower G, right? When you have a decrease in G, that gives you a negative delta G. It's spontaneous simply because the system is trying to attain a more stable state. And in this system, the system is the chemical reaction, the transition state has the highest G value of these three things graphed here. All right. So notice that G, free energy, Not delta G. G is the Y value. So there's three different values here. The G value for the reactants, the G value for the transition state, and the G value for the products. Well, the transition state is higher than both the reactants and the products, G. And so energetically, that really represents a bump in the road, a hill that you have to get over in order for this reaction to happen ever. Okay? But if you ignore the hill and the road for a second and just think about the reaction itself, what kind of reaction are we looking at here based on definitions I've given you?
Exergonic.
It is an exergonic reaction. Excellent. Because the products have a lower G value than the reactants. So energy is coming out of this system when it happens. That's by definition an exergonic reaction. An endergonic reaction would have a similar curve on it, except you would start out with a lower G, go to a transition state, and then end up with a higher G than you started with. Still, the transition state would be higher than both. All right? And so that means whether it's exergonic or endergonic, the transition state, which has to be gone through in order for this to happen, is actually the most unstable part of it, the most energetic in terms of free energy. And how high that hill is going to affect how likely this thing is to happen, right? So this is an exergonic reaction, which you should also should assume is going to be a spontaneous reaction, right? But remember I said last time that a spontaneous reaction, even though it can happen on its own, it's not necessarily going to happen anytime soon, right? Well, that's because it has to get over this hill. Even though you're ending up farther down, you still have to get over the hill. And sometimes just the energy required to get over that hill comes from the environment in the form of the heat that's available. But it has to get over that hill. And so if there's a way to make that hill shorter, then it will be much more likely that this thing's going to happen. That's the point. Now, what is it that makes the hill shorter? What is it that's going to decrease the height of that hill that you have to get over? A catalyst. That's exactly what a catalyst does. Okay, so notice the arrows here. This vertical range is labeled as E sub A. That's short for energy of activation, or the activation energy. That's the amount of energy that has to be supplied by the environment in order to get over that hill that represents the transition state. And what was your question?
The heat is most likely to react faster.
That's right. If things are moving faster, which is what high temperature is, that heat is energy. And if that's enough to supply the energy of activation, then it can get this reaction going. But notice that there's also an E sub A for an endergonic reaction. It would be this height. Okay? And since that's a vertical distance, that means that's an energy, right? Because Y value is energy. But notice that delta G is defined by the difference between the product G and the reactant G, just as we've already defined it. Importantly, though, delta G does not at all depend on the activation energy. Right? This could be a tall hill, a short hill. It's not going to affect this difference between product and reactant. So delta G is a, for any given chemical reaction, delta G is the same. Okay? Now let's look at a very similar graph in slide 14. It's basically the same graph for the black trace. What's added on top of it is the red trace. The red trace is the same exact reaction with the help of an enzyme. And notice that all the enzyme did was somehow reduce the activation energy. That's exactly what all enzymes do, all catalysts. Every catalyst operates by somehow reducing the activation energy for the reaction it's specific for. But just as importantly, related to what I was saying in the last slide, no enzyme ever changes the value of delta G, because that's defined simply by the reactants and the products. All it's doing is making E sub A, or activation energy, lower. And there's different ways that that can happen, because there are different enzymes that work differently. For instance, for a catabolic enzyme, which is an enzyme that works catabolically, so it's going to break a big thing into a smaller one, so it has usually just one substrate, the big molecule. If it binds to the active site of that enzyme, it might do that in a way that actually stresses the bonds of the within the substrate. The chemical bonds get stressed because it's squeezed or stretched somehow, and that makes it more likely that it's going to break into smaller chunks. That's one way an enzyme could work. If it's an anabolic enzyme, there's going to be two substrates, right? Because anabolic reactions are ones that build bigger things out of smaller chunks. So one way that that could work, and it's not the only way, but one way, is that the active site will bring those things in, those two substrates, in such a way that they are positioned perfectly with each other so that it makes it much more likely that they will form a chemical bond between them. Okay? So however it happens, doesn't matter. The point is that any given enzyme is going to do something that has the effect of reducing the activation energy. And if it gets that hill short enough, then it's much more likely that the available heat energy of the environment will be enough to get over that hill. It's shorter to get over that hill. Now, 15 is just a cartoon of this space-filling model. So you can see that this is a complex molecule, which you'd expect for a protein, and it has a complex shape. But although the overall shape is part of the protein, the real important part of that shape is the active site. Because the active site is like it's kind of like a lock and key mechanism. The enzyme's like the lock. Well, the really important part of the lock is the shape that accepts the key, right? And the key in this case would be the substrate. Now, enzymes are very specific. We talked about this a little bit before. There's no one master enzyme that can speed up all reactions. You wouldn't want that to be the case, because then you wouldn't be able to control individual reactions, right? This is why a huge fraction of your genes are devoted to coding for proteins that will be different kinds of enzymes, because you have thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions happening at the same time in your body. You need to control them individually by speeding them up individually with enzymes. And you control these reactions by either having the enzymes available or not, right? Because if the enzyme's not available, even though, as I said, enzymes are not necessary for a chemical reaction, it will slow it down so much that it basically turns that reaction off. Okay? Well, in this case, it doesn't matter that we're looking at a particular, well, it isn't even named as an example. So this is just a generic example of an enzyme and a substrate that comes in and combine to the active site. But I've said all that before. What I haven't said that this illustrates is that a substrate is another example of a ligand, right? Because it's another example of a ligand binding to a protein, because the substrate is something that binds to a protein. In this case, the enzyme is the protein. What did I say is always the consequence of that? In general, if a ligand binds to a protein, what happens? It could be a signal molecule binding to a receptor. It could be any sort of thing. As long as it's something binding to a protein, what happens? A conformational change. What's the conformation? The shape. So yeah, in general, when something binds to a protein, that protein changes shape. It's also true for enzymes. And you can see that here. Notice the shape of this enzyme before the substrate is bound to it. It's a little bit tighter space in here now that the substrate has bound. And so we call this induced fit. To induce simply means to bring about, right? So there's already a pretty good fit between the enzyme and the substrate. But once it binds, that fit gets even better because the act of binding induces an even better fit by changing the shape of it. It kind of wraps around it. It's kind of like an analogy between, it's kind of like the difference between someone who just offers the hand but doesn't grasp during a handshake. Some people are like that, and other people will really grab you hard. That grab hard handshake is like the induced fit of an enzyme. It really wraps around the substrate. And that is important because it basically excludes the rest of the environment. It puts it in its own little space. But anyway, it's called induced fit. And once you have that happen, once it's no longer just an enzyme and a substrate separated from each other, you have what's called the enzyme-substrate complex, which is temporary, of course, because that's going to then lead to the reaction occurring, which means the reactant is going to get turned into product, and then the product is going to be released from the enzyme, and the enzyme will be reusable. As long as there's more substrate, it will keep doing it over and over. We see that happening in slide 16. Now, this happens to just be an example where there are two different substrates, but that doesn't have to be the case, right? There can be one substrate or more. So don't be confused into thinking it's always two substrates, two products. That's just an example. However many substrates, though, they come in and bind, form the enzyme-substrate complex. There's the induced fit. And something happens because of that that reduces the activation energy. And that's what speeds up the reaction millions of times, usually. And that turns the reactants, the substrates, which are reactants, into whatever products, however many there are, which then just get released. That puts the enzyme back into its original conformation, so it's ready for another round to receive more substrate if it's available. So the cycle there emphasizes the important point that catalysts in general and enzymes specifically are reusable because they're not actually reactants. They don't get turned into anything. 17. It's two similar graphs. They both are rate of reaction on the y-axis, but there's two different variables for the x-axis. On the top, it's temperature. On the bottom, it's pH. And I've talked about this in a different chapter. When we were talking about acid rain, for instance, I said two important environmental variables that can drastically change the shape of proteins, if you change that variable, are temperature and pH, right? Which is why a big part of our homeostasis in our body is to maintain proper pH and proper temperature. Enzymes are proteins, so this affects enzymes as well. And what we see on the top is a black trace for an enzyme in a human, and a red trace for an enzyme that does the same job, catalyzes the same reaction, but instead of in a human, in a bacterium, and specifically a thermophilic or heat-tolerant bacterium, one that lives at temperatures that would kill most organisms, boiling water temperature. Well, notice that they both have a curve to them, but wherever the peak of that curve is represents the best situation. That's when there is the best fit between the substrate that enzyme is responsible for and the enzyme itself. And that best fit obviously depends on the shape, right? This is why enzymes have an optimum temperature at which they work and an optimum pH at which they work. And what that optimum temperature or optimum pH is depends on the particular enzyme and the particular organism that you find the enzyme in. So, you know, it's natural selection has refined this over generations. So now humans' enzymes work best right at 38 degrees, which is normal human body temperature. Okay? Whereas the red one in the heat tolerant has 75 or so degrees. That's very hot, 75 centigrade, right? That's so hot that the enzyme from that's doing this job in the humans would be totally denatured. It goes down to zero activity if it gets even to 50. Because a body temperature of 50 is you're going to be dead as a human. But 50 isn't even good enough yet. It has to get even hotter for it to have just the right shape in the bacterium. Okay, and similarly for pHs. In this case, on the bottom, though, it's not different organisms. These are both human enzymes, and they both do the same thing of breaking proteins into smaller chunks. But the black one is a stomach enzyme that works at much lower pH, very high acidity. Right, the stomach is pH of 2, roughly. It varies. Whereas the other one is an enzyme that works after the stomach in the small intestine, where the pH is much more like the rest of the body, closer to 7. Okay. Well, if you change the temperature or the pH in either direction, and not very much from its optimum, it's going to change the shape so drastically that it's not going to work nearly as well. It might still do the job, but it won't do it nearly as well. Yeah.
Now, is that current? Because I know humans have evolved and changed.
Yeah, but yes, this is current. This, humans and really most mammals are pretty much a range of the high 30s, close to 40. Dogs are a little hotter than we are, for instance. But yes, somewhere in 35 to 40 is what most mammals are. We're 38. But these bacteria that live in hot springs can not only survive lethal temperatures to us, but they even they thrive in those temperatures. They actually don't do well unless it's hot. All right, now to 18. I talked a little bit before about control of reactions. And that control over reactions is exercised by controlling the enzymes themselves, because if you have a way of shutting down an enzyme, that's really effectively a way to shut down the reaction itself, because without the enzyme's help, it's not going to happen very quickly. Well, we have just normal binding in A. This is what we've been talking about already. So the purple thing is the enzyme. As you see, the substrate has a corresponding complementary shape. Fits nicely in there into the active site. So that's stuff we've already talked about. What we haven't talked about are B and C, which is inhibition in both of those cases, notice. Inhibition refers to turning the enzyme off, in effect. It inhibits its ability to serve as a catalyst, so it's turning it off. But these are two different kinds of inhibition, competitive and non-competitive. Competitive inhibition is pretty easy to understand. It's called competitive inhibition because two different materials are competing for the same active site. Only one of those, though, is the normal substrate for that enzyme. Okay? That's called the substrate still. And if it wins the competition, it will get into that active site and it will get turned into whatever product. In other words, it will just be normal binding. But sometimes there's a different kind of particle that will fit into the active site well enough, even though it's not the normal substrate, that it will block that active site. And if the active site is blocked, the enzyme, even though it's present, is not going to work as a catalyst because the substrate won't be able to fit in there with the competitive inhibitor, as it's called, blocking the active site. Okay? So when you think about it, there's a couple ways you could control the enzyme and therefore control a reaction. You could destroy the enzyme, because if you destroy the enzyme, it's no longer there, and obviously it's not going to work, right? If the next moment, though, you need that enzyme again, you're going to then have to go back to the drawing board, to the DNA, turn on the gene, make messenger RNA, and then assemble the new protein one amino acid at a time via translation. That's going to take time and energy to do, right? So it would be much more efficient if there's a way that you could keep the enzyme around for a while, but turn it on and turn it off with some sort of switch. And that's what non-competitive inhibition is all about. Did you have a question?
Yeah, what are some examples of competitive inhibition?
there's all kinds. I don't have a good example of a specific chemical, but because a lot of this is the way a lot of drugs work, though. Pharmaceutical industries will, you know, if the problem is that you have an enzyme that is working too much, for instance, then an appropriate drug would be something that is shaped just enough like the substrate that it will fit in there and block that enzyme. And therefore, that has the effect of turning down the rate of reaction because, you know, you have a population of identical enzymes, however many are in the cell. If a bunch of them are busy being bound to the non-competitive inhibitor, which would be the drug, then they wouldn't be working, and therefore you wouldn't have nearly as much of the reaction. It would bring it back down to a normal level. But there's, you know, this is what they do when they design drugs. They try to find molecules that are have the right shape and will interact with proteins correctly. Yeah?
So that's the reason why our medications are mostly like servos and
oils. You mean the pills themselves?
Yeah.
No, that's just to appeal to our aesthetics. Same way with the colors. I mean, they really could all be white spheres, but they make them different shapes and different colors so we can tell them apart, for one thing, if you're taking multiple drugs, so they can be recognized easily. But it has nothing to do with how they operate at a molecular level. Now, I haven't yet described non-competitive inhibition, but you can see that in the middle, it's competitive, right? Because they're both trying to get into the same active site. Only one of them can be turned into product, though. The competitive inhibitor isn't going to get turned into anything. It's just blocking the active site. Okay, now for non-competitive inhibition, which can also be called allosteric regulation, you have something other than the substrate. In this case, it's an inhibitor that is binding to some place on the enzyme other than the active site. Notice this is not the active site. The active site's up here. So it's not competitive because the inhibitor and the substrate are not competing for the same place on the surface of the enzyme. Why does it work, though? Why would the non-competitive inhibitor binding down here keep the substrate from binding to the active site? Yeah. That's right. You have yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein. That changes the shape of the protein such that the active site itself, even though it's open, is now going to be the wrong shape. And so the substrate can't fit in there. If you pop that non-competitive inhibitor off again, it's going to go back, the protein, the enzyme, is going to go back to its normal shape, which will have an active site that's appropriate for the substrate, and it can go back on. So notice this is exactly like a switch, I was saying, which would be much more efficient than destroying that enzyme when you don't need it and then building it brand new again when you need it the next moment. This is much more efficient in terms of energy expense and also time spent. It's a switch, you can just switch it back and forth. So you don't see it here, but you can easily imagine, and I'll show you in the next slide, that non-competitively you could also change the shape so that it's the correct shape, right? In other words, you could allosterically activate an enzyme that's at first, when it's just the enzyme itself, it won't work. But if you bind something to it, it will put it into the right shape so that the substrate can come along, right? So in other words, allosteric regulation can be either inhibitory, or you can have allosteric inhibition, which is what we see here, or allosteric activation, which is turning it on only when the regulator is connected to it. But it doesn't make sense to talk about it's competitive activation, right? If it's competitive, it's going to have to be inhibition because it's in the way. You see what I'm saying there? You wouldn't have competitive activation. That would mean you have to have something come in here to allow the substrate to come in here. Well, that first thing to come along is blocking it. That's why it's always inhibitory. On the other hand, on 19, we can see how an enzyme can be either activated or inhibited allosterically. So notice before on the upper left and the one below it, double arrows here, this enzyme, which happens to be a multimeric enzyme, right? This is a protein that has quaternary shape. It has four identical polypeptide subunits, each of which has its own active site. So it's like four enzymes in one, but it's four copies. Anyway, the overall shape can oscillate back and forth between this shape with the active sites and this shape with the active sites. The top one is the only one that is the correct shape. But anyway, when it's on its own, the enzyme, it will just go back and forth between those many times per second, which means it's only half the time is it available to work as an enzyme. But if you have this green thing, which is an allosteric activator, it will bind to somewhere other than the active site, by definition of it being allosteric. And when it does that, it basically stabilizes it in the active form of the enzyme, because in this conformation, the active sites are the correct shape. Okay, so that turns it on. The red thing is doing the same thing, except it's an allosteric inhibitor. If it binds instead, it's going to lock it into the inactive shape, which is the same thing as this enzyme not being there at the moment. It actually is here, though, which is the nice thing about this, because if you just remove the inhibitor, then it's back to being available as an enzyme. Well, what do we have here on the right side with all the black arrows? What is this thing an example of? It's not a reaction. There are many reactions. And therefore, it's an example of what? Well, each individual reaction will have its own transition state. That's true for any reaction. But what do we call an end-to-end or serial arrangement of reactions, where the product of one reaction serves as the reactant for the next reaction and so on? What is that?
System.
Well, it's a thermodynamic system, yes, because that can be anything, right? You can define anything as a thermodynamic system. But it's called a pathway, a biochemical pathway. Right, it's not a single reaction. It's one reaction that then feeds the next reaction, which then feeds the next reaction, and so on for however many reactions make up the pathway. Well, it doesn't really matter what this example is, but they use a specific example. They're starting out with threonine. That's the initial substrate. And what the cell needs is the end product, isoleucine. Except there isn't one way, there isn't one step that the cell can do to turn threonine into isoleucine. It has to do it by several steps, each of which is a reaction that's just one member of the overall pathway. Okay? So you have these intermediates that are formed. Intermediate A is simply the product of the first reaction, but that's not what the cell needs. That's just what the first reaction spits out. The second reaction then turns intermediate A, whatever it is, into intermediate B, and so on. Well, we can see that each individual reaction, as I've said, has its own enzyme that's specific for just that reaction. So this is several different genes dedicated to just the enzymes of this one biochemical pathway. But the point here is that the cell, at the moment, needs isoleucine. And if it does, if that's true, that it does need isoleucine, then it makes sense to run this pathway, right? But it wouldn't make sense to run this pathway when the cell does not need isoleucine, because then you're wasting a lot of energy. Not only that, but you have isoleucine there that you don't want to have, which could interfere with things. Okay, so the point is, it's any given biochemical pathway needs to be regulated in order for it to be not occurring when it shouldn't and occurring when it should be happening. Well, how does this happen? It uses allosteric regulation in a process called feedback inhibition. This is feedback inhibition because it's inhibition, first of all, as we just defined it. But it's feedback specifically because something is feeding back to an earlier part of the process. Now remember, when we first talked about feedback, negative and positive feedback, first of all, which of those kinds of feedback is responsible for homeostasis?
Negative.
Only negative. Yeah, positive feedback never leads to homeostasis because it makes the error worse, right? But in any kind of feedback, you have an error, which is simply the difference between the set point, the desired value of whatever the variable is, and what the true value of the variable is at the moment. Well, in this case, the set point is the appropriate amount of isoleucine. Okay? And if the cell continues to need isoleucine, then it will continue to use the isoleucine that's getting produced continuously, right? Which means you're still going to be on the short end. You're still going to not have enough isoleucine until you make enough. So there's going to be an error, right? That error basically allows this to continue. But eventually, the cell will have enough isoleucine. And when that happens, it's no longer going to be using up the isoleucine that's continuing to be made. And therefore, the error goes into the other side. The error now is too much isoleucine, not enough. Not enough, but too much. All right? So that's the error, but how does that error actually signal the shutdown of the pathway? Well, isoleucine itself acts as an allosteric inhibitor of this first enzyme. So this is the site in which isoleucine can bind, as you see in close-up here. And if it is bound there, then it will deform the active site for threonine. And therefore, threonine won't be able to fit in, and that will shut down the first reaction. When you shut down the first reaction, you shut down the whole pathway, right? Because reaction 2 can't run without the product of reaction 1, and so on. And by the way, it usually is the first enzyme that gets regulated like this. Even though you could do it with enzyme 4 or any of these enzymes, but why don't you shut down the later enzymes instead? Any one of them would shut down production of isoleucine, which would be appropriate because you already have enough. But why would you want to change it to shut it off by shutting down the first reaction rather than a later one? Yeah.
Yeah, like a buildup.
Yeah, you're going to unnecessarily make all these intermediates that you also don't need, right? So it's better to nip it in the bud. Shut it off right at the source, then you don't have to waste any energy or materials going through these other steps that aren't necessary. But that's called feedback inhibition, and it's an example of allosteric regulation. In this case, it's allosteric inhibition, though. But what makes it allosteric? It's inhibition, obviously, because it's turning off the enzyme. But why is it allosteric? That's right. That's another name for allosteric. It's non-competitive because the inhibitor is not filling up the active site. It's simply changing the shape of the active site by binding somewhere other than the active site. That's the chapter.